So nice to have you back on this podcast, Dr. Stein and Michael Hodson.
Really great to be here. It's an honor to be with both of you.
And let's get started with the debate between Donald Trump and Kamala Harris, Dr. Stein. I want to know, what is your reaction to that? Just briefly, how did you find it?
I think I shared, you know, basic disappointment and disgust with most of the American people, I think, who felt like there really was not meaningful, meaningful discussion for the American people, whose lives are really in struggle in virtually every dimension of our lives. We did not hear about the crises that the American people are facing, and certainly did not hear solutions. You know, from Donald Trump, we mostly heard about immigrant bashing. And from Kamala Harris, you know, we certainly didn't get clarity on her positions, really on anything. And she was kind of going after Donald Trump's, you know, many character flaws and, you know, his very, his extremely lackluster history, you know, of what he's basically not done for people and where he's, you know, threatened American democracy. But we didn't hear about her and what she's going to do for the American people. So it was really more of the same. I think it's what most people have come to expect, which is why, you know, going into this election, even before this disastrous genocidal expanding war in the Middle East and the ongoing disaster in Ukraine, even before that was an issue for people, over 60% of Americans, a record high number of Americans, went into this election. This is according to a Gallup poll, saying that the two major parties have failed us and have basically thrown us under the bus, and we need another major option. So we are that option, and we are, you know, being discovered, which is a very exciting, really thrilling moment now.
Yeah. I want to talk about what they've mentioned about the foreign policy of the United States, Michael. But before going to that direction, I think the important point is their policy toward the economy of the United States right now. Did they offer anything new in terms of the economy? Because when you see Donald Trump after that, Joe Biden, the policy of tariffs and nothing new coming along. And how did you find it, Michael?
Well, the debates and the discussion in the popular press, the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, to them, the economy is, what's the inflation rate? As if somehow they can show that if the inflation rate is down, the economy doesn't have any problems at all. Well, what they're leaving out of account is everything that's most important to most people. And that is that on the salary that they're getting and bringing home, they can't afford to live at their normal living standards without running into debt. And so more and more you have not only debt rising, but in the last few days, the Wall Street Journal has been showing charts that debt arrears are going way up for credit card debt and for automobile debt. And when arrears reach about 3 months, they're considered to be in default. And so more and more Americans haven't been able to keep up their basic needs by borrowing, but they're not even to keep up with the debt service. Well, the more debt service they've been paid at a 19% credit card rate and 31 or 32% as soon as they fall into arrears, they can't afford goods and services anymore. And a whole new market, financial market, has developed on defaulted credit card loans and defaulted automobile loans that banks are selling to vulture funds that are buying these loans for a few pennies on the dollar and then trying to go after the American family. So the fact that the Americans can't break even as life is organized, their minimum wage hasn't gone up. Their actual wages have not at all gone up with what to them is the cost of living. the cost of housing is mainly. Well, that's not in the consumer price index. The things that are important to Americans, like education, that's not in the consumer price index. All the things that are forcing American really into distress are not because they're not in the index, they're not being discussed by politicians. And that's why Jill is not only the only one talking about an anti-war position, but to criticize the economy and to come out with an economic addressing the problems that most families are facing.
Yeah. Can I jump in there, Nima? And in fact, you know, this was like entirely missing in action in the debate. And very specifically, we have policies to address these crises. Half of Americans right now, half of renters, but actually half of all people, according to the reports, are paying from 30 to 50% of their monthly income to keep a roof over their heads. And, you know, this is a disaster because if you're paying half your income for your rent, you don't have the money left over to pay for your health insurance, your college debt, you know, put food on the table, etc. So people are really struggling. We need an emergency solution to the housing emergency that we face. And there are many solutions there, which are part of our agenda. So we can implement a federal scale rent control to freeze prices as a first approach here to this emergency, because, you know, so many families are one or two paychecks away from being evicted, and rates of evictions and homelessness are sky high. So we really need to act. We can implement a federal rent control policy right now. We can also stop the buyout of housing by the private equity firms, which are consuming housing and driving up the cost because housing is not available. They're hoarding housing and not putting it on the market, as well as, you know, charging higher rents for it. We can implement a tenant bill of rights that prohibits evictions simply to remodel and raise the rent. You know, we can give tenants rights to make housing stable right now. We can also charge a vacancy tax on housing so that any large, you know, private equity firms that are buying up housing and sitting on it, they won't be able to afford to do that if they have to pay a really steep tax on unused housing. So there are many ways we can push that housing back onto the market. And then, you know, the fundamental solution is that we need to invest in housing. This has been impossible since the Clinton era, that is in housing as a public good, as a basically as a human right. We need to have public housing, now called social housing, as it's being built mainly in the EU, where when you're not paying huge profit margins, we can afford to do this. This is a very valuable and reliable use of taxpayer dollars to make quality housing available at low cost, which is permanent housing, housing where you don't get booted out the minute your income exceeds a certain minimum threshold. And it's mixed income housing. And it's housing which is built according to sound environmental principles. It's renewably powered and extremely energy efficient, and built along with public transit, which is another critical need that you're not going to hear, you know, Kamala Harris or Donald Trump talk about at all. What are our real transportation needs, which are, we're not going to meet with electric vehicles, which are, you know, relatively speaking, a very expensive and inefficient way to meet these needs. You know, and that's kind of what the Democrats pride themselves on, is, you know, their requirements, actually, their mandates for electric vehicles. But that's not going to solve the problem. So this is all put together, actually, in our Green New Deal, which we can basically fund starting with simply declaring a climate emergency or an environmental emergency, whatever we want to call it. But the president has executive authority and can actually begin to jumpstart this this overhaul of our economy so that it is renewable, it's sustainable, and we are addressing these urgent needs, not only for environmentally sound housing that comes together with public transportation and the preservation of open and recreational space, which is a really critical part of maintaining our health as well. Communities are much healthier if they have access to open green space and recreational space. So all of this is folded together in housing, together with transportation and energy, which is actually part of our Green New Deal, which in fact, we can unleash over $500 billion every year in public dollars to actually begin to jumpstart it. So that's just like one of the critical emergencies that the public is facing that you won't hear, you know, peanuts about from Trump or Harris. But there are real solutions that are available that have wide support, enormous support from the American public, and which the president actually has executive authority over. So that's just one example. And if I can mention one other real quickly, that's healthcare. Healthcare as a human right for everyone. I'm not aware that the president has executive authority to implement that, but I'm not ruling it out either. This is sort of a research concern for our team at the moment. But suffice it to say, there's enormous public support for this. So this is, you know, this would be our first issue to really focus on because the crisis is enormous. You know, Americans are paying twice as much as the next biggest spender per capita. Canada is the next biggest spender, but we have far worse health statistics even while we're spending way more. If you get a diagnosis of cancer, for example, now, the odds are over 40% that you are going to spend down your life savings within 2 years. 18 million Americans were driven, actually it was 8 million that were driven into poverty in the last year for which the most recent year for which there were records, driven into poverty because of their healthcare expenditures. And 18 million cannot afford their pharmaceuticals and still put food on the table. So Americans are in absolute crisis. It's some 87 million now that do not have adequate insurance. And the Affordable Care Act has hardly budged those numbers whatsoever. There's partial insurance, but it's extremely expensive. Use it. This was a promise of the Biden administration that there would be a public option, that there would be a meaningful bulk purchasing program. And both of those programs, you know, they give them lip service, but public option hasn't been heard from, you know, since Biden got elected. And the bulk purchasing program has been narrowed down to a mere 10 pharmaceuticals by the year 1026 that will allow for bulk purchasing and where the price will be brought down. So people are really angry. They're very angry at Democrats. And that has really been pushing people to the right and pushing people to abandon the Democrats. So they like to blame their crisis on third parties or Russians or, you know, or the FBI, James Comey, you know, whoever they can find, they're trying to blame. But they have no one to blame for themselves because they have been throwing working people under the bus, and working people are really ready for a change, which is what our campaign is all about.
Can I make one point on that? Jill's green program has been out for a while, and she's discussed many of the points on your program. And since the last time she appeared on your show, Nima, people have come out with criticisms and have said, well, it's impossible to have rent control or any of the housing or even public health. I think there's an analogy for all this, and that is the debt problem, the usury laws. America used to have anti-usury laws. You couldn't charge more than 7% or any given percent. All over the country, America and almost every country in the world had anti-usury laws. What happened? All of a sudden, the anti-government forces, the libertarians, said, this is a problem of states' rights. Every state gets to set its own usury laws. So you have, I think, one of the Dakota states, and most of all, Delaware, which is the corporate state where corporations can do everything they want. And corporations say, we don't have a usury law, so why don't all of your credit card companies and usury companies incorporate here? And if you have your head office in Delaware, then you can use our laws and say, this is our state law applied all over the United States. And so now, instead of having a cap on usury, that's why the credit card companies can charge 19% interest and 31% with penalties. So you have the whole Supreme Court now staffed with people who say the president and executive office have no power to interfere with state rights, because that's what the Constitution says when it was written by slave owners that didn't want any kind of federal ability to stop slavery. So we're locked in to this pro-slavery Supreme Court issue that's trying to prevent government from doing anything that is needed to rescue Americans from the economic, the debt dilemma, the housing dilemma, and the medical dilemma that they're in.
Fascinating.
Yeah. And do you want to add something, Dr. Stein? I'm going to go with other questions.
Okay. Yeah, I'll just give a quick reaction, which is that that made me, you know, the thought that triggered in my mind, and I didn't know about this, and it's really, that's fascinating. And this is what I love about these conversations, that I always learn so much every time I come on with Michael. I'm taking notes constantly. It's fascinating. And I was just reading this morning about a different set of laws, but laws that really disadvantage, you know, we the people and prevent us from influencing our foreign policy in particular. And what are these laws? These are actually the BDS laws, the boycott, divestment, and sanction laws, which suddenly appeared, you know, just a couple of years ago. And it turns out there was method to this madness. So these laws basically punish people or institutions for boycotting the apartheid and genocidal state of Israel. So it basically shuts down our ability to influence the foreign policy of this country and, you know, and kind of this moral, you know, crisis that we're facing with this genocide, which we are funding, you know, and we are prohibited from exercising our economic power to try to steer, you know, our foreign policy and to try to stop the genocide. So where did these laws come from? There's a fabulous expose that was just put out by Lee Fong, previously of The Intercept. Now he's got a Substack, and he was featured on Glenn Greenwald. But it was an amazing expose about the money behind this madness. So it turns out there's a whole lot of money coming from the Israeli government going to nonprofits here in this country who are then advocating. And I think everybody remembers those hearings that led to the resignations or the firings of the presidents of several Ivy League colleges because they were tolerating freedom of speech and protest against genocide on their campuses, which was being, really misrepresented as anti-Semitic. They're not anti-Semitic. I've been to a gazillion of these demonstrations. They are anything but anti-Semitic. They are, you know, they are Jewish inspired as well as, you know, Muslim and Christian and just, you know, plain old human rights inspired. It has nothing to do with anti-Semitism, but there's a whole spate of laws now that is reclassifying the demand for justice and equality and to stop genocide. That's classifying all of that as anti-Semitic and then shutting it down. There's this so-called anti-Semitism awareness law, which has passed in the House, hasn't yet passed in the Senate, but it formally classifies anti-genocide or anti-Israel activity as anti-Semitic, and then denies education institutions their funding under Title V or VI, whatever it is. But it begins to put real economic muscle behind the suppression of free speech and the expression of just our basic, you know, human values here. And it, to me, it's just so telling that this is coming from what's essentially a foreign agent. You know, the groups that are doing this are in violation of FARA. And that's, you know, who the Justice Department should be going after. This is where big amounts of money are being put into lobbying on behalf of a foreign government. And if you do that, you have to sign up as a foreign agent. Well, the whole Israeli, you know, PR machine is breaking FARA laws. There's a 15-year jail term that goes with that. And in fact, you know, the Department of Justice is conducting a case right now against the Uhuru 3 and Omali Yeshitila. They won the most important part of their case, but they're still on the hook for another part of it that has like a 5-year jail sentence attached to it. And it's so outrageous. They're going after activists. They're using FARA laws to go after activists for trivial, basically as a matter of lawfare, for trivial violations of FARA, and arguably not violations of FARA at all. These are really free speech. Whereas what Israel is doing, where the Knesset is actually providing the money that's going to these nonprofits, which are then lobbying at all levels of government in order to change our laws to basically attack our basic rights of free speech and the right to protest here, is being shut down by this lobby machine, which is actually in violation of FARA laws. And this is part of our day one agenda, by the way. If we are so lucky as to inhabit the White House next year, this is part of our day one agenda, that we would instruct the Department of Justice to actually take AIPAC to court for their, you know, for their illegal actions as a foreign agent on behalf of Israel. And the evidence is now absolutely overwhelming that Israel's influence machine is very much in violation of our basic laws.
I think what you've just mentioned totally describes what was going on in the debate between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump, because when it came to the conflict in Israel, in Gaza, they were, both of them were competing with each other, and who's the most in favor of Israel. And it's unbelievable. And the way that they were trying to convince the audience that I am the most capable candidate to support Israel. And how, in your opinion, is that possible right now to make a shake? Because the political parties in the United States don't let this rhetoric go, fade away, and fading away from public opinion. And how, in your opinion, the public opinion is in favor of these type of policies? Because when you see these two candidates competing with each other in favor of Israel, here comes the question: they want to vote from the people of the United States. How do they feel about these candidates, these policies?
This is why, you know, we have fought to be in this race on the ballot across the country, because that's the only way you can actually force the dialogue here. Otherwise, you know, they will ignore you. So you can be a very powerful moral voice, but unless you're on the ballot, unless you're actually challenging empire, you don't have a word in edgewise here in this conversation. So we're now concluding, you know, that phase of the campaign, getting on the ballot, and we will be on the ballot for about 95% of voters. We're on the ballot in about, with a ballot line in about 39 states, and that includes the biggest states, just about all of them. And then we're on the ballot as a write-in campaign in most of the others. So we're on the ballot basically everywhere except of like three very small, low population states that do not have a write-in process. But otherwise, we're on the ballot for everybody, so we can actually challenge. What's the point of doing that? You know, I mean, first of all, people are in outright rebellion against our political system. In 2020, one out of every three eligible voters chose not to vote because they don't buy what's being rammed down their throats. And the non-voting eligible voters are low income, of color, and young, exactly the ones to whom our agenda speaks. But people are not fans of the military industrial complex. They're also not fans of the endless wars. And there's enormous public opinion against the genocidal war by Israel and the United States. This is a joint war. Israel is our proxy here. They couldn't lift a finger without our funding this, our supplying the weapons and the diplomatic cover and the intelligence. The war is over the minute the person in the White House decides it's over. So Joe Biden and Kamala Harris have enormous control over this war. They can shut it down in the blink of an eye and with a simple phone call, which is what the American people want. We know, according to a Reuters poll way back in November, 68% of Americans, even back then, when half of the blood and gore was not revealed that we now see every day, 68% already wanted a diplomatic solution and an immediate ceasefire. Since then, more recently, you now have 61% demanding an immediate shutdown of the weapons, an actual weapons boycott, which is what U.S. law requires Anyhow, there are three U.S. laws actually that are being violated by Biden, Harris, and by Congress who keep those weapons going. You know, this is just such a glaring example of the disconnect between our, you know, our elected officials who are basically elected by the oligarchy, by the economic elites who fund this, versus the American public who want it shut down. You know, there's hardly, you can count them on one hand, the number of congressmen or senators and women who, you know, who want to do what the American people want here, which is what the whole world wants. So, you know, as I have learned in my years of challenging empire, the American people are actually with us. We do not need to change people's minds. All we need to do is get the word out. And that's why real journalism, like what you do on this program, Nima, is so absolutely critical. The First Amendment is the first for very good reasons. We don't have a democracy without it. The American people need to be informed and empowered about the issues and also about, you know, who our choices are. And that falls to the free press. And there's not much free press out there, which gets to one other thing I want to mention about day one. Another thing that we will do on day one is undertake an antitrust lawsuit against the corporate consolidated media in order to break it up, so that instead of having lapdog media, we have more watchdog media, which is what it needs to be. And we cannot have so much power concentrated into these big corporate conglomerates that basically overshadow and silence the real independent media. So that's one thing. The other thing we do on day one is we begin to re-engage the wheels of democracy. You know, and so how do you do that in a system that is so sold out? Well, one thing that you can do is bring back town hall meetings where elected officials used to have to face their voters. They don't anymore because they're too busy, you know, racking up, you know, dialing for dollars. They're talking to their donors, not their voters. So, and if you're in the White House, you have huge bully pulpit to actually force, you know, force the issues onto the table, and also to really drill down and double down on our elected officials and force them to face their voters. And also, hand in hand with that, we will bring back congressional hearings, meaningful congressional hearings. Right now, they're usually just dog and pony shows. They're political theater. So those are some of the ways that we'll help build support in order to move the agenda. But when it comes to shifting, you know, our foreign policy, there is so much public support for doing that. You know, I'd say that is going to be not, you know, that is going to be the least of our challenges. And that's another day one agenda. The president can actually pick up the phone and tell Israel. In fact, even before getting to the White House, the day after the election, the president-elect can call Netanyahu and inform him that the war is over, the genocide is over, that the weapons, you know, and the financing to conduct this war are done. They're done. And there will be no more support until such time as Israel has complied with international law, not only on the genocide, but also the ethnic cleansing, the occupation, the apartheid state, and the illegal settlements, which need to be basically removed.
Michael, when it comes to the economy, how would the United States benefit from these endless wars? Who's going to benefit from them? Is the donors or voters?
Well, the big beneficiary of the war in Ukraine is, of course, Russia, and secondly, China. We've said before that there's no truth at all that President Biden is a Chinese agent, but if he were a Chinese agent, this is exactly what he would do, by essentially using the Ukraine war, first of all, to bankrupt Europe and drive it in its industry into insolvency and dependency on the United States. And that's like a time bomb that is now leading to, as you've seen with the elections in Germany, to a German and European reaction against the European Union itself and against NATO. President Putin says it's going to take 30 years for them to want to join BRICS, but you can see what's happening. The economic effect is, number one, NATO has used up all of its arms, and from the American point of view, the war in Ukraine has served to exhaust the U.S. and NATO supply of arms, and that means an enormous European demand for American bombs, American artillery, American guns, American tanks, and other basically missiles, other military. The fact that the Americans closed the off the Nord Stream pipeline means that Germany can't afford to make armaments with gas or oil, and you need heat in order to make steel. So America's gained essentially the European market, but the price may be that it's lost Europe economically. Well, of course, within the United States, the whole war budget has been so large that if the Democrats and Republicans get the aim that President Obama wanted to promote as a bipartisan view, if for balancing the budget, if you were to balance the budget under today's military budget, you would have to cut back almost all of the social programs. And that's why President Biden has led the fight to essentially privatize Social Security, meaning ending government Social Security as a human, as a basic human right, and ending, he's rolled back Medicaid for the poor, he's rolling back medicine, that the effect of the war is to give the congressional budget cutters an excuse to cut back social programs, specifically the ones that Jill is promoting is the most important ones. And so that is why the anti-war movement and the movement for economic social spending go together. By cutting back the war movement's military spending, you're now freeing up the budget to support the programs that the Green Agenda has.
Yes, and if I can piggyback on that, if you had to, you know, typically American public opinion and elections typically are not looking at foreign policy, you know, because typically they're very focused on, you know, bread and butter issues, you know, which are front and center in our lives. But in this case, where we are right now, where we're spending 50% of the discretionary budget, the discretionary congressional budget on the endless war machine, and the wars are absolutely catastrophic and we're losing them all, you know, in addition. So not only are we squandering our tax dollars, but we're really eviscerating our budget. And we have, you know, 87 million people who don't have adequate health care. Half of renters, you know, are about to lose their housing. You know, so we have a glaring housing problem. 44 million young people who are locked into student debt. You know, we have horrific disparities in K through 12 education, where the funding in your school, you know, depends on your property taxes. There needs to be a floor, a common floor with federal spending to ensure that all children have a, you know, a quality start and good education. Your quality of education should not depend on your zip code. You know, these are all just really glaring issues that require funding. You know, the climate crisis, the Colorado River is within a year of shutting down. The level in Lake Mead is so low, where the Colorado River originates, the level in Lake Mead is so low that the entire irrigation system out through the Colorado River is at risk of complete shutdown. And that supplies the California agriculture system, which supplies half of the fruits and vegetables for the nation. So you think we have a food inflation problem now, just wait a year until our domestic supply of fruits and vegetables just crashes, which is on the agenda right now, because we're not doing anything about it. You know, the Democrats give lip service to the climate crisis, but they what they're actually doing is serving the fossil fuel industry and the nuclear industry and so on, and to some extent renewables. But building renewables does not address the climate problem. People want renewables. Nature could care less about renewable energy. Nature needs fossil fuels to be eliminated on an emergency basis, which is what our Green New Deal will do. But the point being here that we have all these crises right now that we could be managing, and that we could be addressing these emergencies that Americans are facing in every dimension of our lives. So it's connecting the dots that counts, which is why it's so critical that we get to the microphone. If we get to the microphone, people agree with us and they're also flabbergasted that, oh my God, there are these actual solutions here. Our needs could be met. You know, it's well established. There was a study done out of Northwestern and Princeton a little over a decade ago referred to as Gillens and Page, the two lead authors, that basically showed there's a 0% relationship between the congressional agenda and the actual needs of the American people and what the American people support. So by getting to the microphone and clarifying, the average household, this comes from Jeffrey Sachs, the average household is spending $12,000 this year alone on the endless war machine. $12,000, how much did that serve you? You know, how could you better have spent those dollars, you know, in all kinds of ways? So Americans are extremely upset when it's clarified how much is being absolutely wasted on this endless war machine, which is another item in our agenda that we really want to call out our military expenses so that we have a clear war tax. And it's clear what we are paying for these absolutely futile and extremely dangerous and impoverishing wars. Americans have a right to know that we are paying to the teeth for that while our basic needs are not being met. And that's another reason why we need to throw the bums out and bring in actual public servants rather than these predator servants of Wall Street and the war machine.
Yeah. Whoever talks about the conflict in Ukraine and criticizes the policy of the United States in Ukraine, they're in the mainstream media, they're talking about these are pro-Putin, pro-Russia. But the question, the main question, the basic question is, how would the United States benefit from this conflict in Ukraine? How the ordinary people would benefit from that? Is that just military industrial complex? Because they're going to win from this conflict through the weapons that they're selling to Ukraine and other countries. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, nothing coming to the pocket of the ordinary people in the United States, that everything is taken from them to this conflict, to these endless wars. Michael.
That's really more of a question for Jill. We've been going over just what the problems with the war in Ukraine are. For one thing, it has to do with free speech. You would not have any discussion of anti-war saying, if you're against the war, then you're in favor of Putin and you're in favor of Russia, you know, you're a traitor to the country and you're pro-Russian. None of us are pro-Russian. We're anti-war, and we're seeing that you've had on your show so many former military officers like Scott Ritter and others, and everybody seems to be in agreement. The Russians have all overwhelmingly won in Ukraine. There's nothing that the United States can do except up the ante and risk atomic war. And so you've had a number of people like Scott saying in the last few days, we're really at the risk of atomic war for all of this. Jill has been saying this to me in the last few days we've been talking. So one way that we benefit from ending the war in Ukraine is we're not blown up tomorrow in an atomic war. America thinks that it somehow that Russia doesn't have a real red line, and America and Britain have given Ukraine long distance missiles to attack Moscow. Without question, if Russia is threatened, President Putin has said, you're trying to destroy Russia. Do we really want to live in a world without Russia? I don't. And kaboom. You'll have an escalation that begins bit by bit, and it takes about 6 to 8 days for the escalation to go atomic. So I think the big picture is we benefit from not being blown up.
Yeah. Dr. Tsai.
Yeah, I think we cannot stress that enough, because our criminal warmongering political leadership is oblivious to this, and they are putting all of our lives on the line. They are hiding behind this misconception that, oh, don't worry, the nuclear war will be over there, you know, and we're just going to use tactical nukes to fight it, which is a whole like generation of nuclear weapons that were created in order to fight these regional conflicts. But that is BS, big time, extremely dangerous BS. What we call tactical nuclear weapons right now are the size of weapons that were used in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Those are the tactical ones, not the big guns that they also have. If you look at one nuclear armed submarine, whether US or Russia, I think we have parity somewhere around 12 or 14, each of us. But just one nuclear armed submarine contains the equivalent of 5,000 Hiroshima bombs. It doesn't take many of them to cause global nuclear winter, which is global. Nuclear winter, you know, when you see that mushroom cloud going up, that mushroom cloud is basically a conveyor belt, and it is conveying debris into the upper atmosphere, you know, like above the clouds, where there is no weather to bring it down. It doesn't rain down. It doesn't settle down. It stays there for decades. So basically, we dim out the sunlight, and it doesn't take many nukes to do that. It doesn't matter where it happens. If there are some dozens of nuclear weapons exchanged in Ukraine or in the Middle East, where we're also very substantially at risk for escalation. We are on the escalatory ladder right now, and it can go nuclear very quickly, as Michael was saying, and we could talk more about exactly how that can happen in the Middle East as well. But it doesn't take a lot of these weapons to basically dim the sky enough to make us starve. And depending on how many nukes, it might be agriculture production goes down by 10%, which will starve a lot of people, or it may eliminate us all. It doesn't take much. If there's a major exchange of weapons, it's curtains for all of us, because agriculture production shuts down basically right away. So this is not survivable. And people live under the mythology that a small regional nuclear war over there is not a big deal. It absolutely is. And all of us need to treat nuclear war like it is a personal threat to every one of us, not just our children, but to us. And the nuclear treaties that used to kind of keep a lid on this and provide some protection, you know, right now, for example, you can have very short-range missiles. That is legal now, the so-called Intermediate Nuclear Forces, the INF Treaty, which was dismantled basically by the U.S. a couple of years ago. That was like one of the last treaties to go. There's still one more, but it's on its way out. So this treaty that prevented the short-range missiles ended. The short-range missiles are especially dangerous because that's where the there's enormous incentive to send off your nukes. If you think you're under attack, you've got a hair trigger. Motive to send your nukes. And it leads to lots of jumping the gun. So that was recognized as an incredible danger in Europe. And that's where the INF treaty came from, like in the 1980s. And the American public, really the public all over the world, made that happen because we were aware of what a threat this was to us. Now that threat has kind of been buried, you know, by the industry and the takeover of, you know, corporate advertising and all that. So people are not aware of the danger, but they need to be made aware because this is huge and it's happening right now. And we are very much in the target here. So there's all the reason in the world for us to go to the table. You know, I've been under attack a lot lately by the Democrats, who are really scared because we're doing great. We're actually doing really well and our numbers are coming up. We are actually winning the Arab American and the Muslim vote, for starters, in three swing states, and we're very close to winning in many other states as well. But this has completely freaked out the Democrats because they will not win without overwhelming support from the Muslim community. They cannot win. So they are completely freaking out right now, and they're looking for a way to attack me. This is where AOC's attack that, oh, you're predatory, you go away except for every 4 years. Well, no, we don't go away. It's the media that goes away. We're still here. We are electing people to lower office. We're doing the whole thing. You're the predatory one here. In fact, you stole our Green New Deal and pretended it was yours. No, you take our programs regularly, our student debt abolition, free public higher education, all that was launched by Greens, you know, basically taken over in a predatory fashion by the Democrats, who just give it lip service. They don't actually do anything here. But the Democrats are completely freaking out. So their mode of attack right now, because they can't come up with anything. You know, I've been around too long. You know, my bio has been thoroughly exposed. There are no gotchas. You know, I was investigated for 3 years by the Senate Intelligence Committee as a Russian asset. They couldn't find anything. So I was exonerated on that front too. But they're trying to resurrect that again. And they're trying to, you know, make me say Putin is a war criminal. They want me to say that. Although I've said these are criminal wars. These are criminal and illegal wars launched by Russia. So they're really on my case right now to try to Putin smear me. But I think it's not getting traction. Like we've the the Democrats have cried wolf about this enough, so they're not getting traction. And people, you know, at the end of the day, have a hard time putting food on the table, keeping a roof over their head, getting health care, you know, getting out of debt. You know, our lives are in a shambles right now, and the Democrats keep trying to distract with these nonsense smear attacks. So I really want to encourage people to go to my website here before I forget, jillstein2024.com. We are in an incredible position right now to really build this uprising. The uprising is happening. The Democrats continue to lose, and Republicans both continue to lose traction because they're not addressing the crisis that they've caused, the many crises that they've caused. So it's really a great time. And this is a black swan election. There have been many 180s, and I wouldn't rule anything out. Whether we win 5% and have a whole lot of funding for the next race, so we don't have to, and also ballot status, so we don't have to fight our way, you know, spend the first 9 months of the campaign just fighting to be in the race. You know, that's one great outcome. You know, journey of 1,000 miles begins with one step, and getting to 5% is huge. Or I wouldn't rule out, when you have a four-way race and there will be three pro-genocide candidates, and we will be the only anti-genocide, anti-war, pro-worker, climate emergency campaign on the ballot across the country. There's only one of us. So they could split the pro-war vote three ways, potentially. When you have a four-way race, it can be won with as little as 26% of the popular vote. So don't let them tell you that resistance is futile. It's not futile. It's actually the only thing that ever changes, you know, the course of history. As Frederick Douglass said, power concedes nothing without a demand. We are that demand. Don't let them talk you into holding your nose and voting for a genocide. We do not, you know, we should not be talked out of our humanity. We should not be talked into endorsing and empowering genocide, which is what you do if you are voting for it. You know, there are so many reasons for us to stand up and fight for what we deserve and what is within our reach more than ever in this election and going forward.
Dr. Stein, when it comes to the Middle East, you mentioned the risk of having a nuclear war in the Middle East. We've seen that the Netanyahu administration did everything to bring a bigger conflict to the Middle East in terms of their conflict with Hezbollah, with Iran, with those assassinations. And right now, it seems that the way that we're witnessing with these two candidates, Republican and Democrats, both of them are in favor of Israel. With both of them, we can have this risk of a nuclear war in the Middle East. The way that Netanyahu is capable of manipulating these candidates and in the way that he wants to be the conflict. And could you elaborate on that? What is the most important thing, most important issue when it comes to the foreign policy of the United States in the Middle East in order to avoid any sort of nuclear war?
Exactly. And it's not hard to see how that happens. You know, the U.S., when Israel, you know, conducts an outrageous violation of international law, like attacking the embassy of Iran in Syria, like assassinating, you know, leaders in Hezbollah or, you know, Iran, when Israel does really provocative things, the U.S. is out there telling Iran and Hezbollah to exercise restraint, you know, please exercise restraint. But they never say that to Israel. And look at what Israel has just done in the last 2 days of detonating these paging devices, pagers, and walkie-talkies, allegedly of Hezbollah, but who knows who's carrying it, you know? This is an unbelievable act of terrorism. And thousands of people have been wounded and many killed, including children. So what's going to be the response to that? I mean, this is really provoking Hezbollah here. And if you're going to provoke Hezbollah, you're provoking Iran, which is in alliance with Hezbollah. And who's in alliance with Iran? Both, you know, particularly Russia, which has a military alliance with Iran, and increasingly China, expressing support also for Iran, but especially for Russia, you know, and U.S. warmongering and opposition to both China and Russia is bringing them together. So the U.S. is really upping the ante here and allowing Israel to really supercharge this conflict in a way that is going to be very deadly, and which, you know, the war between Lebanon and Hezbollah and Israel right now is flaring in a very big way, at the same time that Israel is also expanding its, you know, its violence beyond just Gaza, and the violence in the West Bank now is off the charts, and the strategy of basically appropriating, taking over the West Bank is now out, that Israel is not trying to disguise the fact anymore that it is trying to acquire the West Bank and basically increase its occupation. You know, we are in the makings right now of a conflict that has no end. Yet this is a conflict with which the U.S. can end with a simple phone call. But they're not going to do it. Only we can make them do it, you know, which is why for me, the political strategy here is absolutely critical. The politics of this can solve it. You know, if we're in the White House, this war is over and we completely avert this expanding, catastrophic, potentially World War III, which we see in the makings right now around Israel's genocidal war. We have the power to stop that. You know, we're looking at the campus protests being shut down now. They haven't been completely, but there are all kinds of constraints on those protests, and the students have to worry very much about being blacklisted, about being thrown out of the university. You know, so the screws are really being put on them. And I think it's so important for us, for all of us, students in particular, to embrace the political power that we have collectively. If one out of every three voters did not vote in 2020, you know, and that's largely of color, young, and low income. If we're getting the word out to those people, we can completely change the outcome of this election simply by getting the word out and engaging people. So we already have incredible courage and vision and, you know, and a moral imperative that the Muslim American community and the Arab American community, they are standing up in spite of the heat that's really put on them, in spite of the Islamophobia, in spite of the violent attacks against Muslims and Palestinians that's going on in this country. You know, a child, 5-year-old who was stabbed some 25 times by their landlord, you know, for being Palestinian, simply, you know, in spite of all that, they are standing up. They are standing up to do what is right here, and the only way forward. Well, the African American community is also discovering us. We were brought on with my running mate, Butch Ware, that I would love for you to have on this program as well, who is actually a professor of Islamic history and the history of colonialism and revolution, particularly in Africa, but who really has a deep understanding of many of the issues that, you know, that all of us that are first and foremost, you know, are really lead in our agenda as well. That is colonialism, occupation, and revolution. That we have, you know, really been able to put out a very different agenda, and you know, and the because we were able to go together, and he's an African American, onto the Breakfast Club, which is like one of the most popular media shows in the Black community. We have now gone viral in the Black community. And while we were under attack on that program, they brought out a CNN, a former CNN talking head, Democratic Party apologist, who attacked us ruthlessly on that program. But we, you know, we had the space to fight back. And if you read the comments on that program, they're all like, well, I wasn't going to vote before, but now I'm going out to register to vote because, you know, I'm going to vote for the green ticket here. That community is discovering us as well. And they are very much in rebellion for having been, you know, abused and taken advantage of. You know, talk about showing up every 4 years. Well, that's typically what the Democrats do. You know, the Republicans don't show at all, and the Democrats show up once every 4 years and then abandon their promises. So at any rate, we're in this moment of incredible discovery right now. And, you know, it's just really exciting. So I encourage people, again, go to our website and join the team.
Yeah. I think I'm going to have him on this podcast together with you, Dr. Stein. We're going to talk about it. And Michael, right now, It seems that I'm hearing myself through your mic, Michael. It's something wrong with your mic.
Was something wrong with my mic? How is it now? Is it okay?
Right now?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's working?
Same issue. No problem at all, Michael.
Okay.
Let's go ahead with the question right now, Michael, would be with what Dr. Stein has mentioned so far, in your opinion, how, as an economist, you can help her to bring some sort of sanity to the whole situation, considering the economy of the United States right now?
Well, we've talked together, I think, for many years, I'm her economic advisor, so we've had a lot of discussion back and forth. But because we only have a few minutes left, I want to I want to tie together something that's even more important that links everything we've been saying, and that is we've talked about free speech before and how free speech is under attack, not only by against people who are anti-war, who are accused of being pro-Putin, but the implementation of free speech. The free speech laws do indeed protect free speech, but the Green Party, and Jill Stein specifically, has been the object of lawfare. In other words, they've been trying to keep, to bring all sorts of frivolous cases against the Green Party to sort of take up so much time that there's no room or expense financial ability to continue. And the appropriate way to tie all of what we're saying together is for Jill to say just some of the frivolous stalls and lawfare, just like Donald Trump has said, look at all the cases brought against him, that it can all be overturned by the appeals court or the Supreme Court. They're all frivolous cases, harassment. Jill is under the same harassment that Donald Trump has been in, but in an even more I better let her tell some of the problems that she's been having just getting on the ballot.
Yeah, Dr. Stein. Okay, just let me.
No, she's not on.
Yeah.
Is that at your end that she's not on?
No, her mic is off.
Okay. Sorry about that. Yeah, I was trying to help out with that echo before I put myself on mute. Okay, sorry about that. Yeah, so thank you. The Democrats are pulling out all the stops. They are really running scared. They know that their, you know, empire is a losing proposition right now. It's not working. We're losing all these wars. We're spending ourselves, you know, into poverty, spending the American people, that is, into poverty. You know, the paradigm isn't working, but they are glued to that paradigm because that's who funds them, you know, oligarchy and the empire and Wall Street. So they will, you know, defend it to the death. Meanwhile, they are using every tool at their disposal to try to silence us. They are terrified of competing with us. They do not want to be in a debate with us. Their solution is mainly to get us out of contention, to remove us from the ballot. Way back in March, they announced that they had hired an army of lawyers to throw us off the ballot with this lawfare that Michael is talking about. They also have publicly advertised to hire managers for spies and infiltrators to mess up our organizations and our ballot drives. And they also hijacked our public funding, which we qualified, public dollars we qualified for. They hijacked that for a period of about 2 months to prevent us from having the extra resources we needed for our ballot drives. That's why we are on write-in campaigns and not having a ballot line, because they basically stole our resources at the time we needed it. So that's like kind of the large, and then they've got the smear campaigns going on as well. So they have this kind of multi-pronged approach to avoid actually having to have a debate, having to actually meet us face on. So what Michael was referring to in the ballot access, the lawfare, we've been able to beat them back in Wisconsin and in Georgia, which is huge, but we're still in court in Nevada, where we got three times the number of signatures that's required, and they wound up throwing us off the ballot because the Secretary of State in Nevada gave us the wrong form. We were actually using the correct form to collect signatures on. And the differences are really trivial. It's basically a footnote. It's not a substantive difference at all. We were using the correct form. The Secretary of State told us, oh no, that one is obsolete. Use this form. Well, they gave us the incorrect form. Did they mean to do that? Who knows? We don't have evidence that they did, but the first court said, that's not a substantive reason to deny 30,000 voters their desire to have another choice on the ballot. So they ruled in our favor. The Democrats then repealed that, saying, you know, that this form was a game changer. The appeals court sided with them. The appeals court, which I think is largely a Democrat appointed court. We're now taking it to the Supreme Court. Fingers crossed. So far, it's looking promising. So we may win that and be back on the ballot in Nevada. And they also just announced that they're trying to throw us off the ballot in New Hampshire. And we don't yet know the reason for that. But we've got great lawyers. Actually, Teresa Amados, who was the campaign manager for Ralph Nader, he too had enormous lawfare conducted against him. There were some 20 or more simultaneous lawsuits to throw him off the ballot. And they try to spend down your resources. They try to tie you up in court. But we have wonderful lawyers. We've been doing really well. So we are going to be on the court. Rather, we are going to be on the ballot for virtually every voter. So they have failed in their effort to silence not so much third parties as the American voters, who are really clamoring for an anti-war, pro-worker, climate emergency choice in this election. And we're going to get it. So right now, it's really a matter of turning the crank, which is not rocket science. You know, if you have super PACs and big corporate donors, that's great. We don't play that game. We work by the ordinary rules. We do not do the loopholes, the loopholes for legalized corruption, whereby a single donor, a billionaire, can write one check for $1 million. Now, you can't do that under the old-fashioned rules for everyday people. You know, we have $3,300 limits, which is a lot of money as far as most people are concerned. But Democrats and Republicans, they rake in the bucks from these super PACs and what are called victory funds, where a single billionaire can write a check for $1 million. And then, you know, pull the strings from the inside. When you're giving that kind of money, you know, it's a pay-to-play system. And that's why they are, you know, that's why they have the agenda, the Wall Street agenda and the war machine agenda that they do. So we don't play by those rules, which gives us the freedom to actually be of, by, and for the people. But that's why we need everybody out there who wants to see an America that's working for us and a world that's working for all of us. You know, without these endless wars and the climate catastrophe that's rolling down on us right now, and the healthcare catastrophe and the housing catastrophe is one catastrophe after another. You know, we're not moving in the right direction at all. We're actually going in the wrong direction, even under, you know, full democratic rule. We keep going in the wrong direction. So we have a chance to actually change our direction now in a very profound and potentially transformative way in this race alone. It comes down to just the simple ABCs of phone banking, door knocking, tabling, flyering, and fundraising. So if you go to JillStein2024.com, you can be a part of this alternative to a big money machine, is the people-powered machine to create an America and a world that works for all of us at a time when the alternative is, you know, it's literally climate catastrophe and nuclear, you know, Armageddon. That's not where we need to be going. We actually could have a world that's going to work for all of us if we have the courage of our convictions and tune out, you know, that propaganda campaign that's telling us resistance is futile and we are powerless. It's actually not true at all. We have the numbers. We have the solutions. We actually do have a potential pathway to the White House, even in this race. And then we have a pathway for actually governing according to, you know, the needs of the American people. So there's a complete pathway forward if we decide to stand up and make it happen.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being with us today, Dr. Stein and Michael. Great pleasure as always talking with you.
Likewise, a pleasure and really informative. I learn so much every time. Thanks to you both.
Thank you. Bye-bye.